Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. This is part two of my interview with Howard Michael Gould. If you missed part one, after you listen to this one, go back, because it's really interesting. We talk a lot about Mike Nichols and Sybil, and this is a lot of good stuff. But this week is really fun, too, because we get into our writing process. We talk about life as a screenwriter, or as a novelist, as Howard is a TV writer, a TV showrunner, a TV director, a movie director, also a screenwriter, and a playwright, and now a novelist. He has a brand new book called Below the Line, which comes out this week. It's available on Amazon. We'll be talking about that and much more. Part two of my chat with Howard Michael Gould this week on Hollywood and Levine. I want to talk about your process, and then I'm going to get into your novels, because you, more than any other writer I know, are so disciplined. Talk a little bit.
Except maybe you.
I'll work a little bit. I'll have a project and I'll throw myself into it, and then I'll go off and announce baseball for 3 months. But you work pretty much every day. What is your writing routine?
Well, I get up 7 days a week. I get up early and I actually walk to a coffee shop, and then I work there until about lunchtime, an early lunch. On the weekends, maybe I'll knock off and that'll be the day. And then I have weekend left. On weekdays and some Saturdays, I'll go somewhere else for lunch and work for another hour, an hour and a half. And then my brain's pretty fried. And then, the rest of the time is...
But you do that 7 days a week.
Yeah.
What happens when you don't have a project? Okay, it's one thing if you're in the middle of a screenplay. Well, what happens after that? What happens when there's that period where you're just sort of looking for ideas and looking for things to do?
Now that I'm writing books, each project takes a year, so there isn't
so
much
to worry about.
You don't have to worry about that. And by then, you've probably got an idea of, this is the book I'm going to try to write next.
Right.
Which, by the way, means figure out. I mean, these mysteries, the first half of that year is working it out and outlining.
Right.
And
so you're one of those writers that outlines first. You're a plotter, not a pantser, as they say.
Yes.
The guys who just start writing and make it up as they go along.
Yes, I'm on a scale of 1 to 100, I'm like a 352. I don't know anybody else who outlines as fully and obsessively as I do. On the books, the outline itself, by the time I'm ready to start chapter writing, is almost half the length of the final book.
Wow.
So I'm very much that. And it's out of fear of writer's block, really. It was like my way around it. And it's funny, Alexander Payne, who I worked with on one of those things that didn't go a million years ago, when I explained my process, he laughed and he said, well, you're writing the screenplay while telling yourself you're not writing the screenplay. You're just tricking yourself into thinking you're not doing the work so that, you know, you're not freezing up.
Right.
And that's probably right.
But do you write quickly or are you very slow?
It's different depending on the form. So on screenplays, once I have that outline, I write it as fast as I can, as bad as I have to. I think of that as my satchel
page. Kind of your vomit draft, as we like to say.
Don't look back. Right. I think satchel page is what I think is, even if you realize something's, you know, screws you up from before. Right. And then I'd put it aside for a couple of days, and then I'd read it, and I'd write on it what needed to be done. I wouldn't do any rewriting yet. And then I print it out, and then I sit there in red pen and go over it, over it, over it, until, and then type in until my red pen isn't moving anymore, until I go, that's kind of right. On the books, you can't do that, or I can't at least. It's really laborious. I try to write it as well as I can, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph. And then it's really not good enough. I mean, I go back and do a second draft, and I realize it really isn't any good yet. And I do three or four on each chapter till I feel like it's pretty good, and then move on. But I'll tell you on the new one I'm writing, the third in the detective series, which I guess we'll talk about in a moment. But I just have been busy on the movie, which I guess we'll also probably talk about. Mm-hmm. But I was on set and very distracted, and not getting a lot of writing done, or in dribs and drabs. And I thought, you know what? On the flight back, I'm going to read the first three quarters, because I had the full outline 6 months. I had done 3-4 months of chapter work.
Right.
I'm going to read the whole thing through and then get a running start and do the last quarter. And I just read it through and I went, this sucks. It's I mean, it's okay, but it felt like I had three quarters of an okay novel where I feel really good about the first two. And I'm sure it's because while I was doing my daily writing, I've had this ongoing thing of, oh, is the movie going to happen? Is it going to fall through? A producer's calling, you know, and you've had
this. So you were sort of distracted. Yeah.
And then distraction of actually the work on the movie, you know, little bits of rewriting, Mel Gibson is going to call you in 10 minutes. Okay. Meanwhile, I'm going to work on this page. You're not going to write a damn good page till you know what Mel's calling you about. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so now I'm actually going back to the beginning. And I came up today. I'm in such a good mood today because I came up with a really, really, really good first sentence in the third book. And I went, you know, my first two books don't have great first sentences. This one's going to, you know. And it's a really slow thing.
So how did you transition from screenwriting to novel writing?
Well, I guess there's a couple of beats in here that we missed because it was never a plan. So I finally made a movie, directed a movie, got involved. We can do this in a sentence and get not talk about this. Got involved with really, really shady people on the financing side.
Okay.
And it ended in catastrophe that messed up my career. And then I had a few years not knowing what I was doing. Then I had a TV series called Instant Mom, which we worked together on, which went very well and gave me a little bit of breathing room now to try to do something more creatively ambitious. In that period of time, after the movie went bad and Instant Mom, you know, this gets to the harder part of your question, which is what do you do when you don't have a project? Because it was like career Chernobyl, this movie for me, right? I mean, there was nothing left. It happened just when the economy crashed. So all of a sudden, there weren't, you know, I had taken myself out of the game. The movie business collapsed. There were no more of those production rewrites, those things I had been doing. And my daily work every day was often, okay, I'm going to sit here in the coffee shop and figure out what to write or figure out a pitch or figure out, you know, it was trying for the next thing. And there was like a really tough 4 or 5 year period where I did not really, I mean, after a very, very good 19-year run, I had a really tough 4 or 5 years where another writer friend and I going through it used to talk about this as sort of triage, because I was successful enough prior to that I would still get calls from really good producers who would say things like, hey, what would it look like if you and I did a detective TV show about a woman detective, you know, a movie producer who had no TV, but I was a guy he knew in TV and everybody was trying to go to TV and he'd dangle something. So I would either, I would always have something that was purely original that I loved that I was working on. I would take anything where people would say, here's money.
Right.
You don't even have to jump through a hoop. We want you so much. If you produce this pilot for Nick at Night.
Right.
You know? And I go, okay, I'll, you know, I don't have to audition. I'll take that one and let's see what it leads to.
Right.
What, and then everything in between, you'd sort of triage and figure out, you know, the combination of financial upside, creative upside, likelihood that it's real, is this one worth working on? So in that period, two of those things that came up, one turned out to be Instant Mom.
Right.
Another,
which lasted three seasons, like 65 episodes.
Yep. Yeah. So that was a great run and a lot of fun, really unexpectedly fun. And then another one was, actually, I had a failed pitch. I had exactly that female detective situation that I said. We sold that to Lifetime, and it went to, you know, went to script, and then they had a changeover at the network, and it was dead.
Right.
But it got me thinking, geez, I could write detective stuff. Comedy's struggling a little on the networks. Maybe this is an area, because I'd had fun. And I thought, if I had a great idea for a detective that's higher concept than the female detective thing that we had before, and came up with this character, Waldo, went out with Aaron Kaplan to a couple of networks. At one of the networks, the pitch went so well, they applauded at the end.
Okay.
And then they called 3 days later and passed. Because they said, at our network, which is very successful, we do police, we don't do private eyes. Uh-huh. And I thought, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore.
Yeah.
No more of this drama stuff, because I really don't understand it. Uh-huh. But a producer, from a feature producer who I like enormously, Andrew Lazar, called and said, I've started this new company with a financing producer named Christina Lurie and another creative producer, Steve Schoenberg, who directed the movie Secretary.
Okay.
And we have a small development fund. We'd love you to write something for us. We'd love it if you had a detective with some comedy, which I had that I didn't sell a year and a half earlier. I didn't have a movie-sized story, but I figured out enough of a movie story to BS my way through the meeting.
Right.
For which they gave me, you know, I think Andrew doesn't like it when I say it this way, but they gave me essentially a creative blank check stapled to a very small actual check.
Uh-huh.
And said, you know, go write this. And it was really hard because I wanted to make it a, now it was movie size, not 45 minute episode.
Right.
It was three times as long. And I wanted it to be sort of Chandler-esque complexity.
Right.
And outlined it as
confusing, in other words.
Yes.
You wanted it confusing,
but actually makes sense in the end.
Right.
And I did all of that hard work and then got into writing and remembered that, oh, they wanted it to be funny too. So scene by scene, I'd have to come up with something. Oh, here's the scene where the three guys come up and beat up your detective and say, stay off that case, which you're not on.
Right.
We've seen that 50 times.
Right.
How do we make that funny in a way we haven't seen? And I sort of did that scene by scene. It was arduous. And then I got to the end and I read it and I went, this is like 18 different movies, because I just was trying to come up with funny for each of them. And then I just did, again, this is the thing of having regular habits for me, right?
Right.
Is that because I know what I do when I'm writing is now print it out, now sit there and work it in red pen over and over and over and over. And it was one of the hardest scripts I ever wrote. But when I got to the end and I went, geez, this is good, it felt like one of my best.
Okay.
And this happened right around Instant Mom getting picked up. And right away, we got a director and an actor, and then they fell out. Then we got another director, and he mm-hmm. fell out, an actor fell out.
Right.
And by the time Instant Mom was ending and I had some free time sitting in front of me, I thought, you know, we're not getting this made because they don't make detective movies anymore.
Uh-huh.
Right? There are a lot of detective series.
True. Yeah,
a lot of detective books. I thought, here I've got this good material. I don't know what possessed me to even think to do this, but I thought, let me write it as a book. Let me get the rights back.
Uh-huh.
Write it as a book. Let those producers stay on for the movie version.
Right.
But write it as a book. And I wrote it, I may have told you this, under a pen name when I first did, because I was afraid it would sell and suck.
Michael Howard Gould.
You'll like it. It's Ryan Durker, because the first ball game my dad took me to was the Mets against the Astros. Nolan Ryan versus Larry Durker.
And Larry Durker, I grew up with Larry Durker. Yeah. I'm still friends with Larry Durker.
Are you really? Yes. Uh-huh. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, mention this to him.
I will. Yeah, I will.
It was my little salute to my dad who had passed away. And right away, I got an agent. Nothing else ever happened easily in my entire career. I got an agent right away. He said, I think we'll sell this right away. And it did sell right away to Dutton. And you know, that was the end of Ryan Durker.
Right. And so the first book was Last Looks.
Right.
And that came out like
2018, August 2018.
Wow. Okay. And then there's the second book, which is Below the Line.
Just come out.
And it has just come out, like this week.
Yes.
It has just come out. And again, you talk about making your own momentum. Suddenly, this movie project, this on again, off again, as we speak, they're filming it right now.
Yeah, they've wrapped at this point. But I was there on set and mostly in Atlanta, a little bit here. yeah. Well, they have to do these things fast. Not quite fast, but it's about 30-day shoot, something like that.
And who's in it?
Charlie Hunnam from Sons of Anarchy is playing Detective Charlie Waldo. And as the suspect, the alcoholic big star who may or may not have killed his wife and ruined his life in a big drunken night. That's Mel Gibson.
Wow.
And Tim Kirkby, who directed the Fleabag pilot and the first season of Brockmire.
Wow.
Who's incredibly talented. He's directing it. And these guys have been fabulous. And it's been a great, great working relationship. It's been great watching them just take this to new places by really understanding it and then bringing everything they do as actors and director. It's been a fabulous experience.
Well, the other thing that seems so unique about this, because we've been talking about how writers are replaced and there's all these new writers. I remember one time right before one of the strikes, there was like a big Writers Guild meeting, the entire guild. We were all in the Hollywood Palladium. And Larry Gelbart got up to speak and said, everyone in this room has rewritten everyone else in this room. But you're the only writer on this movie, aren't you?
There's a big asterisk to that, which is that during that actor-director attachment process,
right,
one director at one point said, I love what you've done. I want to do the next draft myself. And went off to do that. And I think they gave him money. And a year and a half later, he had still not written anything.
Uh-huh.
And the great, deus ex machina in that was that he not only signed with my agency, but with my agent, who was able then to tell the producers, he ain't doing it. And so they believed it and then went back to me. But yes, other than the guy who was hired to replace me and didn't do any work.
Uh-huh. But yes. What you see on the screen is you. And that must be so rewarding, especially after spending time in the movie industry. You know how hard it is to get a movie. And, you know, I've had friends who are screenwriters. They write a draft. All of a sudden, the phone stops ringing, as William Goldman says.
Yeah.
They're not involved in the shooting. They're not allowed on the set.
Right.
They come to the cast and crew screening or the press screening and see the movie for the first time.
Yep.
And it's just awful.
Yep.
And there's their name as the screenwriter.
The blaze.
And they're looking
not
around
the credits,
at all of the reviewers, and they just know they're just going to get crushed.
Yes.
And there's like nothing of theirs left.
Right.
So
all you reviewers out there, you can crush me with a clear conscience.
Right.
On this one. That's what you're trying to say.
Well, you know, the same thing with volunteers, where we had all these other writers, and then they ultimately went back to us, and we did all of the writing. And, you know, there are certain directorial choices and things that, you know, that we take issue with. But in terms of the dialogue and all of the lines and everything, that's us. That's us.
Well, these guys,
the stuff that doesn't work, that's us.
There were some ad libs and things like that in here too. But this is even better than what you're suggesting in this way. So I get a call a few months ago. The producer says, Charlie Hunnam, the star, is going, during prep, is going to Atlanta to hang out with the director for a couple of days. They'd like you to be there. And I think, what a pain in the ass. fly to Atlanta and, you know, to go not be listened to or whatever, right. You know, this is going to be. But I didn't really see the benefit. We ended up having this incredible bonding over the work day where we just talked about, each of us talked about the influences, things we were interested in. I listened a lot, you know,
right.
to what they wanted to bring to
nice
it.
Nice that they included you.
It was beautiful. And we leave, Charlie and I were staying at a hotel a few blocks away. Charlie and I were walking out and he says to me, do you realize we were there for 7 hours? And I thought it was about three, you know, it was just great. And then we spent a bunch of the next day together too. And that created this terrific sort of three-way bond. And astonishingly, most of the writing since then has been those guys, one or the other of them, mostly Charlie, saying, you know what I love in the book? Can we get this into the script? Or this thing that you cut for time, can we put this back? And in fact, late in the shoot, I had one of the producers was complaining to me, everything you guys cut is back in the movie. And I said, it's not me. And he goes, I know it's not you, but it's making me crazy. You know?
Look,
so they're great.
Movies get made in editing anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So when might it come out?
Sometime in 2020. I mean, now this is a pure independent. There's a company called Romulus was sort of the lead financing company. Uh-huh. And they've been doing this and quite successfully, you know, make a movie and then find, you know, cut it and then show it and find the distributor.
I mean, there is humor in it. It is kind of quirky and interesting. And in a way, I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who are going to go, I've never heard of this. But in a way, it kind of reminds me of Harper in a sense.
I'll take that.
You know, the Paul Newman movie written by William Goldman.
From the novel by Russ McDonald.
Right.
Right. It was the
right.
first of the Lou Archer novels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll take that.
Okay. So what's next?
Well, I've...
I've got a musical and I'm writing an opera.
I do have a play, which we did one reading of, which the director, Neil Keller, is trying to find a home for. Mm-hmm. I sort of wrote it at, I think, an unfortunate time in the theater cycle world. We were ready with it about 2 weeks after all the theaters announced their dates for the next season. So
right.
That may be a while to figure out. And I'm writing a third Waldo book now.
And you say it takes a year to write those?
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, when I wrote a comic novel, I found it was, at least in the beginning, a real adjustment writing prose.
Talk about that.
What? Well, first of all, you know, I'm so used to just writing dialogue that to be descriptive, you know, and to sort of have a voice and to have a flow and, you know, the whole idea where each subchapter can only be the point of view of one character. You can't have two characters mm-hmm. with their point of views. And like I said, it was, you know, an adjustment. And I enjoyed it. What I enjoyed about it was the fact that I was not going to get notes. I was not going to get a director right. that was going to kill this thing in any way.
Right.
That it was going to be exactly as I presented it. But I missed the audience. I missed the audience.
Yeah. All these forms have their wonderful sides, mm-hmm. and then you miss something else about them.
Right.
You know, and I think you've hit that with this. One of the things that has been lovely about this, which I was not expecting, is that there's a real, very supportive and healthy community of crime writers.
Yes.
There are a couple of conferences
yes.
in the year mm-hmm. that you go to, and there's hundreds of, and so I, you know, I know some of these people and some people who were, you know, the greats who you're meeting and are very supportive and other people sort of coming up behind you too already, you know, and so there's different things that I like about it. Another thing, a craft thing that's interesting. I wonder if you did this. First of all, about point of view, these are all, these novels at least, I have another one I'm working on and shelving for a little bit that jumps around point of view. But this is all in Waldo's head. Okay. So I had a character who was not as verbal as the others around him. So this was actually, this worked and was kind of easy for me mm-hmm. to do. But one thing which I do all the time is I have my screenwriting program open too. And if I have a dialogue heavy scene, I'll write it like a movie scene and rewrite it and rewrite it till the dialogue is there. And then put in all the he saids and, you know, putting down the wine glass and all of that crap afterwards.
Well, what I did, I figured, okay, if I'm going to use the form, and this is my book, Must Kill TV. It's available on Amazon, people. But
it's the only one I have not read yet. Yeah. I should read that.
I'll give you a copy. But the thing I said to myself is, okay, I've never really worked in this form. How can I take advantage of it? And so I had a character, and, you know, this is the first time as a writer that I could do inner thoughts. Mm-hmm. So I had him get crazier and crazier as the book went on. Yeah. As I kept applying more and more pressure, I kept really building those inner thoughts so that the inner thoughts became really almost more important than the dialogue. But I figured, okay, if I have a chance to do this, and I've never had that chance to do it before, take advantage of it and go for it.
Yeah.
And that part of it was really fun because I was writing something that I'd never written before.
Have you been tempted to write another novel?
Yes. Yeah. And my feeling is always if I get an idea and I go, oh, okay, that's a novel,
right,
then that's what I'll do. But I need A, the idea, and B, the coffee shop. And C, an alarm clock.
I will go naturally early, so if we're an alarm clock, it'd be easy not to do this. None of these things ever come fully formed to me.
Hmm.
It's really,
you get a germ of an idea?
Germ of an idea, and you sit there and you go, okay, these are three sentences. Let's riff off of this and then start going, okay, what don't we know yet? And just grind and grind and grind until it grows into something.
And I've got a manila envelope that's filled with ideas and scraps. And, you know, I'll have an idea and I'll go, oh, okay, that's kind of fun, but it's really sort of, you know, unformed. And then 3 years later, I'll have another idea and I'll go, oh, I could marry that with this and I could put these two things together. And then all of a sudden it becomes a project and I kind of mull it over for a few days and eventually something will spark me and I'll get interested.
Do they write quickly, like the plays? If you write a full-length play, does that come quickly to you?
You know, it does. My process, especially with plays, unlike you, my outlines are very thin. They're really kind of beat sheets, the things that need to happen in this scene. But I allow a lot of room for just sort of exploring where things go. But I've talked about this before, where my process is if I have an idea for a play, I will take a couple of months and just riff on different ideas. What about this? What if she does this? What if he does this? What if it's set in Hawaii? What if it's set here? What if they don't get married? What if there's another couple involved? And I just have all of these ideas and I just write them down so I don't have to remember them. And eventually it starts to form. The good ideas start to form. But I really sort of need that month to just allow myself to go in any kind of direction.
And when you're in that place, are you, do you have a working day or are you just living your life?
No,
but it's just alive in your head and
exactly.
You keep a pad nearby
exactly.
for when
exactly. that, or napkins or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, in the shower, that type of thing. Like I say, I then have a file. I go to the computer and I write them down so that I don't have to remember them.
Right. Sure.
You know, that I can just go off and again, think of as many different alternatives and kind of go down that road for a while and see where that goes. Yeah. And it's actually, for me, a very pleasurable part of the process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, now I have a franchise, right? This is like a new thing, right? Because they're, and with people who are looking forward to, I mean, even, you know, the guys who I just made the movie with,
right.
You know, asking me, so when's the third book? Mm-hmm. You know? So one thing that I did a little bit different, people are always giving you little notebooks more than you need, uh-huh. right? That's just a good gift people think to a writer, right. But uh-huh. I don't really handwrite much. But I took one of my favorite ones.
Give me
those.
An Apple Watch.
Yeah. I put one of those on my desk in a special place. And if I ever have sort of like a big, you know, several word idea that feels like it could be one of the building blocks of another one of these.
Uh-huh.
I put that in there. And when it's time to write a new one of these, I go through and I go, which of these look... It's a little bit like what you're talking uh-huh. about. Which of these might marry
right.
to one another?
Right.
Because I do multiple plots and
right.
I always do a big guest character sort of larger than life. And how might those work together?
I'll go through it sometimes and I'll come upon an idea that's from 1979, and I go, you're never going to get me.
Not appropriate anymore, or just like, it's been sitting there for so long,
sitting there for so long, it just, this one just did not clear the hurdle.
Yeah.
Well, this is great. Again, the name of the book is Below the Line. It's really fun. It's really interesting. Very clever, and you do a very good job of plotting logically. You know, I mean, I don't go through your stuff, and I find this to be like in your play, because I read your new play as well. You know, and I'm one of those sticklers for, well, why did he do that? Yeah. Why did she go there?
Yeah.
You know. You cover all that stuff. You really do.
I do, and when I miss, my Jiminy Cricket is my wife. she read that new play that you, and I, without telling anything about it, I said, what do you think? She said, I think you got real problems in this play. I said, why? She said, gunshot residue. Like, oh, you know, and it's something that I solve in a two-sentence speech
right,
at some point,
right.
You know. But she'll... You know, she'll lock on those things.
Uh-huh.
And she's got a great BS detector when we're watching something, too. You'll
uh-huh.
be watching a movie that's really good until the moment where she goes, he wouldn't do that.
Right.
You go, she was right. And it's a, you know, the movie gets weak. And she's usually like 2 minutes ahead of where the movie's going to
uh-huh.
go off the rails.
That's great.
Cool.
Great.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Ken.
And there you go, Howard Michael Gould. And again, his book, Below the Line, is available now at Amazon. Our thanks to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to John Wolfert, Howard Hoffman, Bruce and Jason Miller. And if you want to get in touch with me for any reason, please do. I have an email. It is hollywoodlevine@outlook.com, hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. At Ken Levine is how you get a hold of me on Twitter, and I'm also on Instagram. Who isn't? I'm on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Back next week with more. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Hollywood and Levine.